Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is Connecting Faith. We're here to reconnect the eternal with the everyday, make those conversational connections with the headline news and the mind of Christ, seeking to equip each other to enter into the conversations of the day filled with grace and truth. We want to be ambassadors, effective ambassadors of Jesus Christ in the conversations of our day. I'd invite you to follow me on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. You can read my blogs and other ministry materials at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Today at reconnectwithcarmen.com, you can get a free ebook, 10 Ways to Fan the Flame of a New Reformation. All you have to do is become a monthly supporter of the ministry, and you can do that. We call it a reconnector at reconnectwithcarmen.com. All right, so how do we bring the headline news sort of into submission to the mind of Christ, or how do we bring the mind of Christ to bear on the headline news of the day, whichever way you want to frame it? You guys asked me, like, okay, how do you do it? You wanted a little how-to, and so I thought we just do it that way. We just say, all right, what's the headline, and then how do we bring the mind of Christ to bear? So here is the leading headline right now, literally right now in the LA Times. This is the leading headline. STDs in LA County are skyrocketing, and officials think racism and stigma may be to blame. So, yes, in order to bring the mind of Christ to bear on this particular headline of the day, I feel like I have to tell you what the article is about. And yet, as soon as I say that I'm going to do that, I am aware that I would be embarrassed to read the lead of this article in any kind of Christian environment. Certainly, I would be embarrassed to read the lead of this article in a Christian environment where there might be children listening. And so suffice it to say, the lead of the article would be considered sexual harassment, would be considered absolutely untoward behavior, except that it takes place as a part of the sex education, sex health education during something called Spring Into Love Day, a recent all-day event in the LA public school system. I don't even hardly know what to tell you other than it's a modified version of hot potato, and what they are passing around is then something onto which a condom is to be opened and applied. And this is something taking place among teenagers at school in an organized school event, a recent all-day school event called Spring Into Love. It was intended, now I can read from the article, intended to get high schoolers more comfortable talking about sex. The hope is that open dialogue will make them more likely to seek out condoms and STD testing and eventually reduce the spread of the disease. Okay, STDs, just in case that's not language you're familiar with, are sexually transmitted diseases. This article in the LA Times deny that sex is actually to blame. The story's lead, again, I think would be considered sexual harassment in any setting, except that apparently it's not, because it happened in the public schools in the LA school district, and what they call traditional ways of preventing STDs. Now, just for you and I, this for sake here, the traditional ways of preventing STDs would be what? Will they be abstinence? First of all, that would lead the list. Protected sex might be second on the list, but traditional ways of preventing STDs would certainly include abstinence and protected sex. Instead, traditional ways of preventing STDs are described in this LA Times article, and again, this is leading the news in the LA Times, at the LA Times website right now. They describe the traditional ways of preventing STDs as patients seeing a doctor regularly in order that they could get screened and treated. So instead of seeing moral bankruptcy as the problem, what is being blamed in this article are, quote, social factors such as income and education, as well as racial discrimination. What is being blamed in this article for a skyrocketing increase of STDs in LA County among school-age people is not that they're having sex and unprotected sex, and obviously with multiple partners. That is apparently not what is of grave concern. What is of grave concern is that resources are not being allocated in a way that is viewed as fair in terms of everyone having access to the same kinds of medical screening and treatment in order that the spread of STDs could be minimized. Okay, so I'm hoping you already see the disconnect. I'm hoping that you already see that the disconnect here is that we have disconnected sex from marriage, and we have disconnected marriage from God. All right? This is pretty simple disconnect conversation in terms of what's going on in the culture. What is the reconnect? Well, the reconnect is, first and foremost, returning sex to its rightful sacred location in the context of a covenant marriage, monogamous, lifelong covenant marriage between a man and a woman. That would be ideal here. That would be the ideal reconnect. What's the connecting point? Actually, how do you get into a conversation with young people about these kinds of things? Man, I would start with this. If you're gonna have the LA Times up on your browser, or you're gonna have a copy of it in your hands, I want you to ask a teenager: Have you ever been asked to do anything like this at school? That would be my starting point for a conversation. If you got a public school student that you have any kind of access to, doesn't really matter to me, you know, what your relationship to that person is, right? I want you to ask them, have you ever been asked to play this kind of game at school? And how does that make you feel? And let's talk about why God gives us the great and good gift of sexuality and sex, and what the context is in which that's meant to be shared, and why that's so great and so glorious, and why it must be protected. And down you'll go down the road of why pornography is so dangerous, why objectifying other people is so dangerous, and certainly why engaging in promiscuous sexual activity is dangerous. Yes, including, but certainly not limited to, the dangers of STDs. All right, here's the next headline. We're going to go from California to Iowa, Kansas, and Oklahoma. All right, and you're going to see a dramatic shift in the kinds of conversations that we're going to be having in terms of the headline news in Iowa, Kansas, and Oklahoma versus the headline news in the LA Times. And I'm lifting that up to make a point, and that is that geography matters in the conversations that we're having about worldview. All right, so here's the headline out of Iowa. Iowa's new fetal heartbeat law is really about the Supreme Court. Okay, so you can read it in the Des Moines Register. You can read it in the USA Today. The headline news is that there is a new abortion ban law in Iowa, and it is related to when the fetal heartbeat can be heard. Why does this matter? Well, because Roe v. Wade, which is the case that we refer to in relationship to the Supreme Court of the United States, where a woman's right to terminate the life of her unborn child was basically created. The Supreme Court essentially created a right that is not guaranteed, in my view, by the Constitution. And so since the passage of Roe v. Wade, pro-life Christians in particular have been seeking an opportunity to have that decision revisited. And obviously, not only our awareness of what's happening in the womb because of technology and our ability to actually see those little people as they are growing, but the advances that we have made in terms of viability. And Roe v. Wade set the abortion law essentially at the point of viability. Well, viability is getting younger and younger and younger. And so fetal heartbeat is now considered maybe the place where we should be seeking to have abortion limited in this country nationwide once a baby has a heartbeat. Let's have that be the point at which we say beyond that point, you cannot terminate the life of that human being in the womb. And so this is really forcing the issue. There's no question that that's what's going on here. And this leads us to a conversation, again, about just how important worldview is in terms of everything from who we elect at the state legislature level. Like, who did you elect to go and represent you in Congress at the state level? Because that's where these conversations are going to be had. That's where the conversation has been had in Iowa. It's only because Iowa's House, Senate, and Governor's Mansion are occupied by pro-life individuals that this was able to pass in Iowa. And so having passed in Iowa, we feel very confident that there will be those who seek to have this legislation overturned by action of the courts. In fact, both Planned Parenthood and the ACLU are already lining up to bring legal action against Iowa in this matter. That's no great surprise. And it leads us back to the conversation of just how important Neil Gorsuch is to the Supreme Court and how important it is that we have a person in the White House who is pro-life and will nominate pro-life judges to the Supreme Court. What I'm trying to reinforce here is that it's all connected. It's all connected. So what happened in Kansas and Oklahoma? Both Kansas and Oklahoma have approved. Well, it's interesting. The AP covers it this way. Kansas and Oklahoma approve religious veto on LGBT adoptions. There's another way to view that, and your worldview matters even when you're reading the headline news of the day. The way I would articulate it is that in both Kansas and in Oklahoma, there are new protections for faith-based foster care and adoption ministries, and then certainly they are being characterized as anti-gay. All right, friends, so why bring these up? Well, because Iowa, Kansas, and Oklahoma, you might consider those heartland states. It's significant. There's a significant division in America. The headline that we read out of the LA Times in California is far different than the headlines that we're reading from America's heartland. Some of the differences in America are demographic, but some of them are geographic. And so I just have you be mindful of that as you are engaging in conversations with others and certainly on social media, because people on social media live in all of those different geographic places. All right, friends, there's a new ebook posted for you today at reconnectwithcarmen.com. I'd invite you to go get that. I got to take a quick break. When I come back, we're going to be talking with Luke Moon from the Philos Project. He and I are going to be talking about Israel. We're going to talk about moving the American embassy to Jerusalem. We're going to talk about a survey of Arab youth. We got all kinds of conversations to be having. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. Hey, friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge. You are listening to Connecting Faith. Joining me now is Deputy Director of the Philos Project. His name is Luke Moon. You can follow the Philos Project on Twitter at Philos Project. You can follow Luke personally on Twitter at LukeMoon1. Hey, Luke, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks, Carmen. It's great all to right. be here on your show.
Yeah, so you are my go-to guy on all things Israel. And so,
Thank you.
Yeah, so next week marks Israel's 70th year as well, certainly as a nation in our generation. I think we forget how relatively young the current nation state of Israel is. So let's just talk about Israel for a moment, and then we'll talk about moving the U.S. embassy.
Yeah, no, it's Israel is coming on its 70th anniversary of actually the modern state of Israel. I think most Christians will affirm that Israel is an ancient nation, one that we. Our Lord Jesus comes from, and so we're excited to see, a good 70 years of progress in that part of the region.
So this is a land that you love, and I know that. I can say that. I've been there with you in Israel. I think I can say it's a land that you love. It's a people that you love. It's a people that you you seem to understand in terms of what they are experiencing and the challenges of the neighborhood in which they live. So can you just take a moment, for people who've never been to Israel, can you describe what it's like on the ground in Israel from your perspective?
Yeah, I'll give you one example. The first time I went, I went up to the Mount of Olives. It was raining. I was overlooking the old city of Jerusalem that's just across the valley. And I I went home and I, or back to my hotel, and I called my wife and I said, you know, today I went and went up on the Mount of Olives where Jesus supposedly ascended into heaven. And my wife said to me, Luke, what do you mean supposedly? And I was like, oh yeah, what do I mean supposedly? Whoa, this is where it all happened. And so as a Christian, it's super cool to be able to be in the places where Jesus walked and taught, and where, you know, the stuff of Scripture happened. But the reality is that that Israel is not it's not a museum; it's a nation. So it's a modern nation that has, you know, all the things that nations have: economies and you know, money and banks and, you know, buses and stuff like that. And so it's great to see this vibrant land where it's such a rich history that we connect to as Christians, but also the people that are living there, you know, are the same people that were, you know, descended from the same people that were there thousands of years ago. And that's a really cool experience to have.
So I love that statement that you just made. That's probably going to be a tweetable. Like, Israel is not a museum. I mean, it's a real nation. Like, real people are living there. They have real jobs. They're raising real families. And they have a real government. And that government has said that their sovereign nation's capital is Jerusalem. But there's been some controversy about that. So can you bring us up to speed on, first of all, why Tel Aviv has been the recognized capital, and why Jerusalem is the capital to which we are now moving the U.S. Embassy?
Right. Well, because of, you know, for a long time, actually up until 1967, from the formation of modern state of Israel in 1948 through 1967, Israel was, actually Jerusalem was controlled mostly by Jordan. And so it was easy for, you know, nations to have their embassy in Tel Aviv, which was, you know, a safer place. It was, you know, easily accessible to the airport and stuff like that. But once Israel won the war in 1967 and actually reunified Jerusalem, taking the old city, that part of the city, it became an issue of dispute. You know, the Arab world, along with lots of nations outside the Arab world, believed that Jerusalem was you know, a divided capital. It should be the capital of Palestinians, and the Israelis, you know, others thought it should be an international city. But it's the fact that it was so disputed made it you know, unhelpful politically to kind of force the issue. But as we know, this president that we have now is not afraid of forcing issues, and so he forced one here, moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
So you've made some observations in a piece that remind me. Was this posted at Foreign Affairs? Where was this posted?
The Federalist?
You've made some observations in a piece posted at The Federalist about, you know, why Christians support Jerusalem as the capital and sort of what the motivations are for that. So can we just walk around in those? The first one is sovereign countries have a right to determine their own capital. I think that one probably it may not seem obvious, but it is. But your second point is terrorism is going to occur regardless of what position we take. Can you touch on that?
Yeah, I mean, the response out of the Arab world once the decision by Trump was made to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem was 3 days of what they called the days of rage. You know, there was a kind of general, you know, animosity, instigation around the Middle East, but in the Palestinian territory specifically, and just general disruption of what was happening. And the argument was that, well, you know, we got to not do anything because, you know, the Palestinians or the countries in the Arab, rest of the Arab world, they'll get upset if we make this decision. And the reality was that they were going to do that anyways. The problem is that there is not a ton of leverage points that the Palestinians have to offer. And so this kind of their general response to a lot of kind of these political moves is this kind of, we're not satisfied, we're angry, So they'll do these days of rage, and they're not super hostile violent, but there's, you know, tire burnings and that kind of thing. So I don't want to overstate the kind of severity of it, but it's just a real, it's there's a, you know, work stoppage and there's some protests and that kind of stuff. Obviously there's some terrorism involved in that, but it's not a terroristic move.
Exactly.
The important thing to know about this decision particularly is that the Jordanians and the Egyptians and the Saudis were made aware of the decision before the decision was made public, and actually had green-lighted the decision, because it's more important actually that as the Saudis and the Jordanians and the Egyptians, they're more concerned about Iran than they are about Israel. And this whole situation plays into what was happening there.
Okay, well, I want to talk about Iran in just a minute. I love the point that you make about a lot of Christians who support Israel, that support is rooted in history, and it's historical support. It's not necessarily theological support. And then you also make the point that Christians have not always been pro-Jew. So can you sort of walk around in those conversations?
Right. Well, I mean, the reality is that when we read our scripture, we see that, you know, we see King David in Jerusalem. We see the patriarchs. We see Jerusalem as really a major center of the story around which we have our story. And the reality is that, you know, a lot of people in the Christian world, they don't see the modern state of Israel as a fulfillment of prophecy. Obviously, some do. A good number of people do, but not all. And so these people that see Israel through the lens of history still see Israel as a positive voice. They're against decisions like the United Nations decision that basically ignored Jewish heritage and linked to the old city of Jerusalem and the Temple Mount and things like that. And they're just kind of they see that Israel as being uniquely set apart differently than what other nations in the region and the rest of the world are treated like. And then the other point is that, you know, the reality is that Christians have generally been only, you know, pro-Israel or pro-Jewish for, you know, a good maybe 150 years, maybe. I mean, obviously there's some pockets that go older than that, but, you know, if you read the statements from like Martin Luther on the Jews, it's blatantly anti-Semitic, and it's really terrible. And that unfortunately has been part of our history. I mean, we were right up there with everybody else trying to kill Jews for most of the last 2,000 years. And
all right, so we're gonna come
window.
Yeah, we're going to come right back to that subject after the break. Hey, my conversation is with Luke Moon of the Philos Project. You can check it out at philosproject.org. I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is Connecting Faith. We've got to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Hey, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Welcome back from the break. I am in the middle of a conversation with Luke Moon. Luke is the deputy director of the Philos Project. And Philos is a ministry that's really seeking to help all of us better understand what's happening on the ground in the Middle East. And, you know, as a Christian, I really appreciate how the folks at Philos give me a window into what's happening, not just in Israel, but all across the Middle East. And you guys can check it out at philosproject.org. And you can follow the Philos Project on Twitter at Philos Project, and you can follow Luke personally at Luke Moon 1. Luke, welcome again to Connecting Faith.
Thanks. It's been great talking to you.
I think there's probably days when my listeners are like, yeah, she's just talking to one of her pals, and I think they can probably tell that you're a person who I feel very comfortable asking very straightforward questions of. And that's because you will give it to me straight, and you'll also not make me feel silly that I ask. So I'm going to now ask a question that might otherwise sound silly, but I know you will help me understand. You have used the term Arab world. Sometimes we hear the concept of an Arab world view, or we talk about Arab youth. When we use that terminology and when we hear that terminology, what does that mean?
Right. Well, there are countries in the Middle East that are made up mostly of Arabs, and that's like actually a, you know, an ethnic people group, all that stuff. But they are, you know, when we think about the Arab world, you actually it's counter to Iran often, which is Persian. It's often counter to, you know, other groups within the Middle East, like the Turks are not Arab, they're Turks, right? So there are these. You know, when we look across at the Middle East, we kind of see this sea of, you know, dark-haired, olive-skinned people, and just kind of think, oh, they're all Arabs. And the reality is, there's actually a lot of distinct ethnic and racial groups within the region. And this is one of the things that we actually work to foster and promote is that there's all these groups that are finding their foothold. And you know, the Arabs and the Druze and the Alawites and the Armenians and Arameans are all distinct and are valuable. But when we think of the Arab world, we're talking generally about countries like Saudi Arabia and Jordan, Egypt, and even the Palestinian territories, again, mostly Arab. And so it tends to be like more almost like both a people group and a geographical region that we're talking about when we talk about the Arab world.
Okay, so I guarantee you that there are people whose eyes just got wide and their little brows are now lifted up and they're like, what do you mean the people of Iran are Persian and not Arab? What do you mean the people of Turkey are Turks and they're not Arab? I thought the Arab world was everything on the other side of Western Europe. And so I do think, Luke, that it's really helpful every time we're having one of these conversations to actually like stop and define words that maybe you and I would use in casual conversation because it's a region that we have grown familiar with. But I think we have to stop and we have to help other people like say, okay, when we say, you know, even when we say Jews, who are we talking about? And what are we talking about when we talk about Israel? And how is it distinct historically from the modern state of Israel? All of those conversations. And you guys at Philos do such a great job helping the rest of us slow down, define what we're talking about, and then actually give people the dignity of their own heritage, the dignity of their own worldview, like allowing people to bring their own stuff to the table instead of our always setting the table from the West and then expecting people to, you know, talk about what we want to talk about and the way we want to talk about it. So let's talk about what's going on in the Arab world. And in this survey, you and I are both familiar with this survey. I'm sure other people are not. There's an annual survey of Arab youth in 16 Arab states, 18 to 24-year-olds. The new 2018 version of it just came out. And so when we look at what Arab youth, this very large group of people, thinks about the United States, what do we learn?
Well, they generally have a pretty favorable view of the United States. I mean, it's one of the really interesting takeaways from the survey was that, you know, the country where they would most likely like to live in, we kind of imagine that everybody wants to come to America. But the interesting thing about the Arab youth is actually the top country they want to go to is United Arab Emirates. And that's really interesting to me because I think there's a lot of assumptions that we make about Arabs, about the Middle East, about Muslims and how it all kind of ties together. And I think, you know, the survey kind of tears down some of those assumptions. And one of them is that, you know, there's a hatred towards the United States, but also that everybody wants to come here. And neither of those are actually true.
Hmm. So the survey, at least in this year's version of it, 35% consider the U.S. an ally. But 57% of the young people that were surveyed And again, we're talking about youth in the age band of 18 to 24, which is actually a demographically huge cohort in the Middle East. So we're talking about 57% of these young people see the United States as an enemy. When we use the term enemy, what do you think we're talking about from an Arab worldview?
Well, I think you have to understand that, like, just like most millennials in the United States, that same demographic group, their coming of age when the United States was at war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, like, if I was to do a survey of American youth, I think you would find a similar view towards the region, where it's like, why are we engaged at all? We tried that. We tried regime change. That's the last. But the reality is that, like, so much of people's perception about America or about the region comes from what was happening between the two groups in their formative years, when they were, like, in high school, right? Like, I mean,
right.
I often ask the millennials that I'm with, I'm just outside their, that boundary, how old were you when the U.S. was in Iraq and Afghanistan? And it's like they're 12, 13, 14 years old. And we all know, like, when we are 12, 13, 14 years old, we're learning about the world and how we fit into it as a nation, as a people that's distinct from other nations and other peoples. So it's not really a surprise to me that there's this kind of general, antagonism. And it's largely because of the experience of the Arab world in their formative years. Now, does that hold, long term? I don't know.
Yeah. So, again, friends, I'm talking with Luke Moon, Deputy Director of the Philos Project. You can follow Luke on Twitter at LukeMoon1. I think you anticipated my next question, which is sort of this, why should we care? Do you perceive an existential threat to the West from the Arab world, or to the United States from the Arab world? And maybe back to our earlier conversation, is there a real existential threat to our Christian brothers and sisters and other religious minorities in these Arab states? I know those are two different questions, but I think they're both important for Christians to understand.
Yeah, I mean, they are different, but they're related. I think we have to, as Christians, we have to have, a I don't know, not necessarily a globalist view of the world, but a global view of the world. We actually have to pay attention to what's happening in the rest of the world. But relatedly, I think we also have to recognize that what we're after, I think, as Christians, is a pluralistic, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multicultural, but it's like there's a beautiful picture of the Middle East that is distinct from, what ISIS is after, which is a mono-religious, mono-linguistic, monocultural Middle East. And I think we have to be clear that we stand against that, and we affirm the rights of minorities and other religious communities to engage, to practice their faith. I think it's important that we as Christians stand with them.
So let's talk about the Saudi prince. He's sort of informally known as MBS, Mohammed bin Salman. He is very iconic among sort of this emerging generation of Arab youth. He seems to be wildly popular among Western media. Tell us what we need to know about him.
Well, he's not just wildly popular among Westerners. He's actually wildly popular among his own youth. I mean, the survey itself, 90% say he's a strong leader, right? Like 91% support him. Gosh, if anybody in America as a political leader got 91%, I mean, everybody would be fawning over that person, right?
I have 91% affirmation among people I survey.
Of course.
It's all about who you ask, man. Yeah, okay, go ahead.
It kind of is, but it's also kind of not, because it's a blind survey. The thing is, what the Crown Prince has done is that he has nodded in all the right directions that the Saudi youth are after. I mean, they opened a movie theater, talked about women being able to drive. He's actually been very clear about the future potential relationship with Israel, which is a very positive thing. And so he seems to be a very thoughtful, pragmatic, popular leader within Saudi Arabia, and I hope he can last a while.
Okay, now remind us, when we're talking about Saudi Arabia, which variety of Islam are we talking about?
Saudi Arabia is Sunni. So the countries that line up with the Sunnis, particularly vis-a-vis Iran, would be the biggest ones are Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, and part of Iraq, but only part of it.
Okay. I just always think it's helpful. It's always, just a little bit helpful to clarify those things. All right. So one last question.
No, but it's really important, though, because one of the things that anybody observer from the outside has to know about what is happening currently in the Middle East, you have to understand that there is an Islamic civil war taking place between the Sunnis and the Shia. And everything that happens, whether it's with Israel, even ISIS, anything that's taking place, it's all within that framework of this Islamic civil war. And the major players in that are Iran and Saudi Arabia. And everybody else kind of is lining up behind those two powers, right? And it's really almost ignore what the news says until after you filter it through that framework of, all right, who are we talking about, the Sunnis or the Shia?
All right, which would lead to our conversation, which we can't really have yet because we don't actually know what the president of the United States is going to do in relationship to the sanctions related to Iran and the nuclear deal. So maybe we'll have to come back and have that conversation after that story has begun to unfold a little bit more.
Yeah, it is a good question. I mean, the news is speculating all day long about this, but one of the things I think it is important for us to know is that it would be a very bad thing for the world and the region if Iran actually got the capacity to have nuclear weapons, because what that would mean was that the Saudis and the Egyptians would have it pretty quickly after that. But that's the last thing the world needs is more of that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Luke Moon of Philos Project, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith. Again, friends, you can visit them online at philosproject.org. You can follow Luke on Twitter at LukeMoon1. He's got 3 international trips in the next 6 weeks, so his Twitter feed should be full of all kinds of interesting fodder. Hey, Luke, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Great talking to you, Carmen.
Likewise. All right, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about whether or not the Met Gala was sacrilegious. I know you don't want to miss that. This is Carmen LaBurge. I'll be right back. Hey, friends, indeed, all my hope is in Jesus. I hope all your hope is in Jesus, too. I'm Carmen LaBurge, host of Connecting Faith. Thank you for joining me here this afternoon. I didn't really have an interesting connecting point to share with you, and I have this very cultural conversation I really want to have. So we're going to take today's ending segment here, and we're going to talk about the Met Gala. And you're saying to yourself, I don't even know what the Met Gala is. Well, the Met Gala is this annual event that takes place at the Met. And it's a chance for Hollywood's elite to come to New York City and show off opulent fashion. Like, that's really the goal of the Met Gala. And every year it has a theme. And it appears to me that the Met Gala is now an event in search of a theme. And so let me just read you from this particular version of the story. Comes from Fox News, but you can pull it off of lots of different websites today. Here's the lead. The Met Gala is a chance for Hollywood's elite to show off some of the most opulent fashion of the season in New York City. In 2018, the stars pushed the envelope trying to be on the event's theme of heavenly bodies, fashion, and the Catholic imagination. The event showcased an exhibition of items from the Vatican and other Catholic-inspired artistic items. And to keep up with what the stars would be seeing inside the ultra-private event, they were asked to arrive in garb that showcased the imagination of the Catholic Church. Okay, so there's so many things in there for us to talk about. And because this is radio, I will now have to describe to you the pictures that I'm looking at. Kim Kardashian arrived in what's described as an over-the-top look, capitalizing on familiar imagery in the Catholic Church. I'll tell you, she's nowhere near as wackily dressed. I don't even know if wackily is a word, but it is today. Rihanna, who served as the co-chair of the event with Donatella Versace, kicked off the night arriving in an embellished white mini dress with a matching cropped jacket and hat emulating that of the Pope. Now, I got to tell you, I've never seen the Pope in an embellished white mini dress. Thank God. But there you go. And then Sarah Jessica Parker shows up in an outfit that I'm not sure is inspired by anything other than, wow, a Catholic nightmare. I don't know if you've ever had a Catholic nightmare, but she's wearing it. Let's see. Perry, who is this one? No. Let's do Director Greta Gerwig. Whoever made this nun-like ball gown for her, wow. This is, it's all black. It obviously covers her from the chin to the floor and completely down her arms. And it looks like it's a glorified nun's habit. Katy Perry arrived dressed in a golden mini dress accessorized with larger than life angel wings. And she posed for all of her photos on the red carpet, kneeling in the position of prayer. And then here's the one that, trust me, if you're not undone yet in terms of provocation and mockery, here we go. Actor Jared Leto sought to be reminiscent of Jesus himself, wearing a blue Gucci suit and golden headpiece emulating Jesus's crown of thorns. First of all, the only reason he's reminiscent of Jesus is because, by the way, he wore his hair down in long, dark locks and has grown a full beard and mustache. Again, he's seeking to look Middle Eastern for sure. But the idea that closely reminiscent of Jesus would be reflected in a blue Gucci suit and golden headpiece emulating the crown of thorns is nothing short of mockery. And so here's the challenge that we face. We live in a culture that is more than happy to make a mockery of Christ, more than happy to make a mockery of the religious. I mean, what they're describing as imagination. It's not a religious imagination. It's reality. It's the truth. We're talking about not just a historical figure in the person of Jesus. We're talking about a contemporary figure in the person of the Pope. And wherever you're at in terms of your theology related to Catholicism, it's still not okay to make fun of the people of the church. It's not okay to publicly mock them. Nuns who have given their lives in service to the Lord and to people ought not be mocked by Hollywood nor by New York City's elite. And so let me just keep us mindful that, you know, God is about that which is good and beautiful and true. And yes, this event is about art, but this event is also about culture. And when we have reached the place where in our culture, it is okay for Hollywood to entertain itself and seek to entertain others by mocking God, I just think that we've reached a point where we need to stop and we need to say, this is a bridge too far. I don't know how many of you remember Madonna's giant cross that she used to wear when she performed. You know, wearing the cross, taking on your cross every day and following Jesus is not supposed to be a put on. It's supposed to be that with which we are willing to live in order that he might be glorified, in order that his kingdom might be advanced. I I become less in order that he might be exalted. And so I guess my encouragement today is, man, don't let your Christianity, don't even let the cross that you're wearing, don't just let that be a put on. And certainly don't allow it to become a mockery of who Christ is. You and I are out there every single day representing or representing Christ. All right, hey, the news is now out reporting that Trump has decided to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. So suddenly our conversation with Luke Moon and other things related to the Middle East, it was relevant 5 minutes ago. But now, literally, we're going to say, how do I bring the Christian worldview to bear on the headline news of the day? What does this mean for the United States via the action of the president to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal? It does not make the Middle East any more or less unsafe. It certainly will draw greater attention to what Luke described as the ongoing civil war in Islam between the Sunnis and the Shias. It will certainly it will affirm our friends in some of those Arab countries who disagree with the potential rise of Iran as a nuclear state. It does undo action of the last president, and so there will be international concerns, I'm sure, raised about whether or not America can be trusted one president to the next in terms of deals we enter into. I would resist any sort of sky is falling fear-mongering that you are going to very likely hear perpetrated by those who like to think that anything, frankly, that happens in Washington provokes a sky is falling response. I heard Condoleezza Rice just last week basically say, look, I mean, if we get out of the Iran deal, we get out of the Iran deal. There'll be another deal. Deals are struck and broken by governments all the time in many and various ways. Few of them this high profile. But let's just like the sky didn't fall after we announced that we would be moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the sky will not fall by the United States withdrawing from this particular deal with Iran, especially if Iran has not been doing what Iran was supposed to be doing, which is evidence produced by Israel just last week. So there you go. I realize that it's a lot of international intrigue. And those may not even be the conversations of the day that you're most interested in engaging in. And so what I want to say to you is whatever conversations you're having today, let the mind of Christ be what rules in your heart. Be governed by Christ in every single one of your conversations. Be a person who recognizes that you are representing Christ always and do so in all ways. Let's seek to be the people who are glorifying Christ in every single one of our conversations. So how can you advance the cause of Christ in the conversations that you are having today? If you want some equipping in that, I've got resources posted for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com. And hey, I want to say thank you to all of you who emailed me yesterday. I gave the email address so that people could, you know, jump in if they wanted a book. But I appreciate that some of you took advantage of that to just send me an encouraging email about what you think about the show. So a little shout out to those of you who give us feedback. We sure do appreciate it. You can email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. You can always call us on the studio line, 877-93-FAITH. And if you call the studio line and you just want to leave us a message and tell us what you're thinking, I'm pretty sure you press the number 2. Pretty sure if you press the number 2, you can leave us a message. All right, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is Connecting Faith. I love to meet you here every day. I recognize that you have a choice in how you spend your time and how you engage the conversations of the day. So thank you for sharing this part of your day with me. Visit me at reconnectwithcarmen.com and join me right back here tomorrow for another edition of Connecting Faith. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith.
Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.